Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
A search for the truth behind an international drug smuggling plot.
How are we going to unravel this all?
From the BBC World Service, this is World of Secrets, Season 5, Finding Mr. Fox. Search for World of Secrets wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. I'm Celia Hatton, coming to you live from London. We start today focusing on monumental flooding in large parts of Spain following torrential rain. One town, Chiva, in the Valencia region, recorded 1 year's worth of rain in just 8 hours. The authorities in eastern Spain say at least 62 people have now died and dozens are unaccounted for in flash floods around Valencia. Videos shared on social media show cars floating along swollen, muddy rivers. Some people are shown clinging to trees or rooftops to avoid being swept away. These local residents in Leitour, in the neighbouring region of Castilla-La Mancha, describe the situation there.
A flash flood came down. It wasn't raining here, but it came down from the mountains. It was already coming down with pine trees, branches and everything at the same time. It came down very strongly. Yes, it went all the ravine down and one of these bridges broke as the water jumped to the road, taking 3 or 4 cars with it.
A house disappeared. A house at the entrance of the town just disappeared. And there are at least 2 people who they don't know if they are still missing or not.
Pilar Bernabe, a government representative for the Valencian region, urged people not to go outside.
Practically all the main roads have been cut off, and the secondary roads as well. Therefore, not going out is not a mere recommendation. It's a necessity to guarantee the safety of the people who are stranded on the road, and of the people who have to go and rescue other people who are in the municipalities that they've not yet been able to reach.
And Spain's Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez told reporters that the government was doing everything possible to help people in the affected area.
There is lots of people suffering and people facing uncertainty, but we're going to help them. We're going to have all the resources for those people to be able to recover their lives and also their homes. To the towns and cities that have been affected by this, I'm just saying the same. United, we're going to recover everything, your cities, your squares, your bridges. Spain is behind you.
Meanwhile, at a news conference in Brussels, the President of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, expressed her sympathy for those caught up in the floods.
What we are seeing is devastating. Entire villages are covered with mud. People seeking refuge on trees and cars swept away by the fury of the waters. Tens of people have lost their lives. Thousands are displaced. And therefore, our thoughts are with the victims and with the families and their friends, but also with the rescue teams.
She also said that the European Union was preparing to offer emergency assistance to Spain and warned that the EU needed to prepare for more such disasters. Well, Neil Hesketh is a reporter with Sur in English, an English language newspaper in southern Spain. I spoke to him a short time ago and I started by asking him for the latest news.
Spanish media is reporting 64 confirmed deaths in the areas affected. That's where people's bodies have been found. There's still a huge, and I mean huge, search going on, rather like a hurricane disaster zone, door by door, trying to reach these people in these towns. The area affected most with deaths is the southern suburbs and sort of outer ring of the city of Valencia, where this rain and water from the mountains surged down the hills with very little warning through the rivers and swelling the flow and flooding people very unexpectedly.
You mentioned very little warning, it was unexpected, but how prepared was Spain in general for this kind of flooding?
Absolutely. Well, they were forecasting very heavy rain, but not this much. Something like half a metre fell in the worst affected place in the space of just 12 hours, which is an incredible amount. What this was caused by is a cut-off low, which is a sort of drop of low pressure at high altitude that floats around Mediterranean areas at this time of year. So Spain's aware of it, and they talk about it a lot. The Spanish word they use is Dana. But no one expected it to be this heavy, least of all the people in the city of Valencia, where it wasn't raining very much. It was raining 20, 30 miles away, and of course they weren't expecting it.
And Neil, just briefly, how long is this weather expected to continue?
Well, the characteristic of this Dana, this cut-off low, is it floats around fairly uncontrollably. And today it's raining heavily up in the Catalonia and Aragon areas, the same weather system, and also off to the west in the Andalusia area. And they're actually predicting it will go on all week bobbing around. But because of its nature, it can't really be forecast. Fortunately, it's not moving over water where it can suck up new water and generate new rainfall. But I think it's going to be unpredictable for at least for the rest of this week.
Neil Hesketh is a reporter with SUR in English. Now, Neil mentioned the weather in the southern suburbs of Valencia City. Let's focus in on that area for a moment. Consuelo Tarazón is the mayor of Horno de Alcedo, a town of just 1,300 people, a few miles from the center of Valencia. It's experienced some of the worst effects of the flash floodings. I spoke to the mayor a short time ago, and I asked her to describe what happened last night.
By 8 p.m. in the night, water started coming in great amounts and the town was flooded in minutes. The currents were so quick and we called the emergency services who started rescuing some people who had water up their necks. But we've had a very terrible night.
Now that the night is over, what have you woken up to today?
Well, things are calmer now. Although this morning we had a fire in a paint factory that also covered the area with a very big and toxic smoke, but everything is sorted now. The area is still flooded and the truth is that we are having a total catastrophe.
What does the town look like after so much water flooded so quickly?
It was a terrible vision. In my 58 years, I've never seen anything like this before. Generally, the water comes from the lower parts to the higher parts of the town. But in this case, because water has been coming from other towns in Valencia, it has been running through other villages and it first flooded the higher part of our town.
Did you receive a proper emergency alert ahead of the flood?
Yes. We had three alerts and we couldn't believe that that was going to happen to us. So we got one 30 minutes before the flood started. One other alert when the water was covering at least 1.5 meters of some of the places in the town. And then one this morning around 6 a.m.
And what's been the government response since the flood? Is anybody arriving to help?
Yes. Last night we had firefighters coming in with small wooden boats because they couldn't get through in any other way. They brought neighbors to my doorstep so they could stay in my house because it is higher from the floods. It has been a wonderful response, and this morning we had to evacuate a neighbor to the hospital and a helicopter came and picked them up without any problem. The response has been very good. Now we have cleaning teams clearing the drains, the roads, moving the rubble, but there is a lot of damage.
Is anyone still missing in your town, or is everyone accounted for?
Fortunately, everyone is okay. No one is missing. There has been a few rescues because some people had water up their necks, but everyone is okay.
You sound very calm, but it must have been absolutely terrifying.
Ha sido una noche muy, muy, muy dura. Muy dura. I'm suffering from lots of anxiety at the moment. It's been a really, really hard night. It was mostly feeling impotent for not being able to do anything. It's been horrible.
Consuela Tarazón is the mayor of Horno de Alcedo. Well, this news from Spain comes on the same day as a major report is released by the medical journal The Lancet, tracking the global connection between climate change and health. The Lancet Countdown Project says that climate change is the greatest global health threat facing the world in the 21st century. Let's hear more on it now. Marina Romanello is executive director of the Lancet Countdown Project at University College London. I asked her how the flash flooding in Spain fits in with global trends of extreme rainfall.
These types of floods will have very persistent, very widespread effects on people's health. First and most clearly is how deadly they are in terms of the increased risk of drowning. And the loss of lives is kind of the second deadliest extreme events if we consider floods as a whole. So they are very dangerous situations. But attached to the direct risk of drowning and injury, there's also an increased risk to health that comes from the exposure to contaminated water, the disruption of sanitation services. And we often see a very sharp growth in respiratory illness, in gastrointestinal infections, and in the burden of disease that comes associated with exposure to sewage water, to contaminated water throughout. But it's not just the floods themselves. We're also seeing with climate change, the change in precipitation patterns is also leading to an increase in drought events that often happen simultaneously, disrupted by these massive rainfall events that lead to floods in a period that generally has been very dry, with associated health impacts as well.
Can you tell us more about the patterns that you found when it comes to drought? How has the Lancet Countdown changed in the past year?
Well, this year's report is particularly concerning. We've seen that in 2023, almost 50% of the global land area was exposed to extreme drought events. And to put this in perspective, it's an increase from just 15% in the 80s. So the increase in the exposure to extreme droughts has been very sharp. And we've seen areas of the world that are very vulnerable, very fragile, being worst affected, like some countries in the Horn of Africa, in North Africa, where we know through scientific studies and statistical studies that climate change has influenced that drought situation that has led and contributed to the acute hunger situation in the region, which then gets exacerbated when these types of events happen. And similarly, in South America, in areas like Brazil, where we've seen that devastation that the extreme rainfall had last year in the south of Brazil with the collapse of a dam, in an area that was also previously affected by a long-term drought with associated impacts as well.
Marina Romanello from the Lancet Countdown Project. And you can read more from the project's latest report on the BBC News website. Coming up on NewsHour, do animals get drunk? We talked to the author of a new scientific study.
When male flies are ejected by a mate, they tend to increase their intake in alcohol, which I'm sure maybe don't know many humans can relate to. And then with the opposite, female flies have been found, if they take in a fair bit of alcohol, it reduces their choosiness of mates. So there's quite some interesting behavioural implications.
Some other stories our newsroom is tracking this hour. Spain's prime minister has vowed to use all means available to support communities devastated by flooding in the east of the country. That's left over 60 people dead. And thousands have been fleeing the eastern Lebanese city of Baalbek after an evacuation order from Israel, as it begins a series of attacks on Hezbollah targets there. This is NewsHour, coming to you live from London. Well, as in many countries, domestic violence is a major problem in Iraq.
Reported cases have grown exponentially over the past few years, although most still go unrecorded. Despite repeated efforts to change the law, domestic violence is often not considered a criminal offense, and it's also illegal to set up safe houses. Well, a group of Iraqi women have built a network of secret shelters to try to help women, but it's dangerous, as they've also been targeted by extremists. NewsHour's Rebecca Kesby has been speaking to some of those involved. No. From the outside, no one would be able to tell this is a shelter. It looks like any other normal house.
This is Janat. She helps to organize dozens of shelters across Iraq for women and often their children escaping violence at home.
Is this the one?
It's a network of secret safe houses hiding in plain sight.
When we set up a new shelter, we try to find an area where we won't get asked too many questions, like why there is no man living in this house.
Janat is 36 and a survivor of abuse herself. Many of the women involved in the secret shelters are. In other countries, places like this are in secret locations to avoid a violent partner finding them. But these are also hiding from the state because it's illegal to run a women's shelter in Iraq.
How do women find us? Sometimes it's word of mouth from a friend. Mostly it's by our sites on social media. They get in touch and we try to help.
The women use code names for security. No visitors or mobile phones are allowed because they can be tracked. We've connected remotely online because keeping the locations of the shelters secret is crucial. Some have been raided by the police, others have been attacked by extremists. This is dangerous work.
Some of the women here, their fathers are senior officials of the state or maybe a powerful clergyman. So yeah, there are many risks daily for us.
What do you think would have happened to you had you not been helped by a women's shelter?
Oh, I don't know. I'd probably be dead. Most likely dead.
It's been 15 years since Janat escaped to a shelter like this, and now she wants to help others. Like this woman. Mariam is her code name, and she ran away from her abusive husband a few months ago.
The day I came to this shelter was the first chance I had to get away. I was terrified that my husband would find me and kill me.
Mariam is 22. She's got two little children under five and found out about the shelters from a friend. She says it saved her life.
My family made me quit school to marry a man in his 50s. I didn't like him, but they forced me into the marriage. I was 15. I always had bruises on my arms or legs, everywhere. He beat me in the face many times, knocking me out many, many times.
The Iraqi constitution bans all forms of violence, but Article 41 of the Penal Code still allows for the use of beatings as domestic discipline if a wife disobeys her husband, for example. There's been a campaign for the past decade to change this law, and a draft bill has been put to Parliament four times, but each time it's been blocked by hardliners who want to retain Article 41 and the rights it gives to men.
The situation is much worse than it was 20 years ago. The government has become very fierce in fighting women.
This is Yana Mohammed. She's a well-known Iraqi feminist. She set up the first known women's safe house in Iraq in 2003. She faces constant death threats from extremists and prosecution in the courts.
I was told if I don't stop this work, I will be killed right away, but all women activists are in danger, not just me.
And in fact, you faced a prison sentence just for helping these women.
Just because we want to save women's dignity and to keep their safety in a country where the government doesn't want women to step outside their homes, even if these homes are abusive and kill the women.
Janat is now happily married with children, but she's determined to keep fighting for other women, whatever the risks.
Yeah, this job is really dangerous. But just as I got a chance to rebuild my life, I want every survivor of domestic violence to have a chance. We've got to fight on.
And to hear Rebecca Kesby's whole documentary, Iraq's Secret Women's Shelters, head to bbcworldservice.com/documentary or search The Documentary wherever you get your BBC podcasts. You're listening to NewsHour. Well, what do elephants, spider monkeys, cedar waxwing birds, and even fruit flies have in common? There's scientific evidence that they're just some of the animals that are found to consume alcohol or ethanol in the natural world. A team at the University of Exeter has been documenting the trend. Anna Boland is the lead author of the study.
We wanted to collate all this knowledge and the data that's out there to look at ethanol use outside of what we know how humans use ethanol, which is quite widely discussed. And there's some really great examples out there. So tree shrews, for example, have been found to feed a lot on fermented nectar of the Burton palm. We have evidence that wild chimpanzees ingest fermented raffia palm sap.
Do we understand why animals might want to indulge in ethanol or alcohol? Is there evidence that animals are actually wanting the alcohol, the effects of alcohol, or do they just overindulge in sugary substances containing alcohol or ethanol?
That's a good question. And there's a few hypotheses out there as to why animals might be feeding on these fermented food sources. Whether they're targeting the ethanol specifically or not, we still don't have much data on. So we don't know if they're showing a preference for these things. It could just be that, for example, sugary foods such as fruit, nectars and saps, when they're infected by yeast, ferment. And since animals might feed on these food sources, they'll just automatically ingest ethanol as part of the diet, whether they're sourcing it for the ethanol or not. Other hypotheses that have been put forward is that ethanol has been found to have some medicinal benefits. Also, it could be nutritional or for energy-seeking purposes. Even potentially, although again, not very tested, particularly in the wild or nature, are the cognitive influences of ethanol. It's very unlikely that animals will be chasing intoxication. As you know, when you're drunk, injuries are more likely. And if you're an animal, predation becomes more likely, and it would greatly decrease your survival probability.
And what about the example of male fruit flies, though? Didn't you find some evidence that they indulge in ethanol more often under certain circumstances? Can you explain?
Yeah, so there's a pretty cool study that looks at when male flies are ejected by a mate, they tend to increase their intake in alcohol, which I'm sure maybe don't know many humans can relate to. And then with the opposite, female flies, it reduces their choosiness of mates. So there's quite some interesting behavioural implications that alcohol could have on some species. Again, still know quite little about the behavioural implications in a wild context.
Anna Boland from the University of Exeter, lead author of that study on animals and alcohol consumption.
BBC News with Debbie Russ. The Spanish Prime Minister has promised to use all means available to help victims of flash flooding near Valencia, which has killed more than 70 people. Pedro Sanchez also announced 3 days of national mourning. Dozens of people remain unaccounted for. The Israeli military is launching airstrikes on the eastern Lebanese city of Baalbek, a Hezbollah stronghold. Thousands of people have been fleeing since the city's civil defence agency told residents to leave, following Israeli warnings of the coming attacks. A South Korean court has sentenced a man to 10 years in prison for making and distributing deepfake porn videos. The defendant's accomplice was given 4 years in jail. It's thought to be the toughest such sentence so far. The prosecutor's office in Georgia has summoned the pro-Western president, Salome Zurabishvili, who says Saturday's parliamentary election was rigged. The president has alleged Russian interference. In Britain, the Chancellor of the Exchequer is to raise taxes by $50 billion. Rachel Reeves, the UK's first ever female finance minister, said this would largely be achieved through increasing employer national insurance contributions. She also guaranteed $4 billion of military support for Ukraine each year. The Chinese electric car maker BYD has overtaken its US rival Tesla with an operating revenue of more than $28 billion in the third quarter of the current financial year. Suspected cult members have raided a village in western Uganda, killing at least 8 people. The army said they descended on people mostly from their own family. 4 of those killed were aged under 13. European football's governing body UEFA will invest just over $1 billion in women's football over the next 6 years. It's a new strategy to grow the women's game across the continent by 2030. And that's the latest BBC News.
Welcome back to NewsHour. The head of the World Food Programme has warned that the largest humanitarian crisis ever on this planet will occur if a ceasefire is not agreed in Sudan, enabling aid to reach 25 million food insecure people. Speaking in Nairobi after a visit to Port Sudan, Cindy McCain said there were signs that a key border crossing in western Sudan may close next month, which she said would be catastrophic. The BBC's Anne Soy began by asking her what's needed most to alleviate the suffering of Sudan civilians.
We need a ceasefire. We need it now. We absolutely need it now. And if we don't get that, you're going to see millions of people very close to starvation or entering starvation and dying as a result of it. There's 25 million people that are food insecure right now. And Sudan in particular, because it's such a complex country, and right now there's not enough border openings for us to get our food in at scale. If they close Adre, which is a very real possibility, this is a catastrophe. We won't be able to get in.
The authorization for the reopening of the Adre border is due to expire mid-next month. From your conversations with the authorities in Sudan, did you get the sense that they're considering prolonging that authorization?
They're not hopeful that it's going to stay open, I'll be very honest with you. And they give the reason that they can't control the flow of what's coming in, and they, you know, they have various reasons for it. I disagree. We need to keep everything open and open more so that we can feed people. As I have said publicly and I told them, there's no way that we can help stave off famine unless we can have complete access and safe access and secure access in every way. As you know, humanitarian aid workers have been targets most recently, and that's not only unacceptable, but we can't operate if I have to risk, you know, can I send them in? Is it too dangerous today?
I remember earlier in this conflict that your warehouses were looted. What's the situation at the moment?
It's dicey. The political and military unrest and the factions that are you know, have a great deal of unrest right now are completely collapsing what little system there was. And that makes our job even tougher and even larger.
Are you able to do any airdrops at all at the moment?
Not right now, no. What we were told is a clearance of sorts, but it's not been finalized at all.
And since the Adre border was reopened in August, has that made any difference for the operations on the ground?
It allowed us to get more trucks in, but then the problem was the rains. And we simply physically couldn't get our trucks into where they needed to go in a timely fashion because the roads were impassable, or in many cases, the bridges were out.
What do you need to be able to operate in Sudan?
Ceasefire. Every entry open. The world funding, helping fund this also. As I said earlier, this will be the largest humanitarian crisis ever on this planet if we don't get a hold and if we don't get in.
That was Anne Soy speaking to the head of the UN's World Food Programme, Cindy McCain. More to come on NewsHour. This is NewsHour, coming to you live from London. I'm Celia Hatton. Well, with less than a week until the US election, President Biden is facing criticism after appearing to refer to Donald Trump supporters as garbage while speaking on a Zoom event with voters.
The only garbage I see floating out there is his supporters.
The race to become the next president of the United States is on.
We can't drop the
pace now.
Yeah, it's pretty close.
Count on the BBC World Service to keep you informed on the latest breaking news, with insight and analysis you can trust.
Immigration, if you look at polls, a top concern for so many U.S. voters.
The issue of the economy reigns supreme for everybody.
For a global perspective on the U.S. election, search for The Global Story, The Documentary, and The Global News Podcast, wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Is demonization of Sikhs unconscionable, and it's un-American.
Mr. Biden has denied his comment was aimed at Trump supporters collectively and says he was referring to a comedian who made disparaging comments about Puerto Rico at a recent Trump rally. Republicans, though, have expressed outrage. And that's overshadowed a rally in Washington by Kamala Harris in what was billed as her final big pitch to voters ahead of Tuesday's election. She stood in the same place where an insurrection in January 2021 was led by Mr. Trump's supporters following his 2020 election defeat. Meanwhile, the former president went to Allentown in the swing state of Pennsylvania. Will Grant has the latest from the U.S.
Good evening, America!
With just a week to go, the U.S. presidential campaigns are in the final straight. For Vice President Kamala Harris, that meant delivering what were billed as her closing arguments in Washington, D.C. With the White House visible behind her, she spoke at the Ellipse, the same site from where Donald Trump addressed the crowd on the 6th of January 2021, before they stormed Capitol Hill. She wasted little time in connecting that bleak day to this vote.
He was told by his staff that the mob wanted to kill his own vice president. And Donald Trump responded with two words, so what? America, that's who Donald Trump is.
As the estimated 75,000 Harris supporters streamed out of the event, many felt energized and confident that, despite the polls suggesting the race is absolutely neck and neck, she'd done enough to become the U.S.'s first woman president in November.
She is a problem solver. She wants to get things done. She has a to-do list, and she's going to start from day one accomplishing things that we need to have done.
But while Kamala Harris has been making one of her final pitches for votes in the Capitol, Donald Trump has been focusing his attention in one of the key swing states, Pennsylvania. All day, people have been steadily making their way into the convention center in Allentown. And while these are the staunchest of his supporters, everyone we spoke to said everything they'd heard on the campaign trail simply reinforced their support for the former president. In the queue for the Trump rally, some held up signs in Spanish which read, Puerto Ricans for Trump, some of Pennsylvania's large Puerto Rican community. Fermin and Sila said they wanted to show their support hadn't been affected when a stand-up comedian at a Trump event in New York on Sunday told racist and xenophobic jokes, including about Puerto Rico. But plenty of Latinos were offended, and in a state on a knife edge, every vote is precious to both candidates. Polls suggest Vice President Harris is well ahead among American women, but young men seem to favor former President Trump. One of them, 23-year-old Christian, said he'd voted for Donald Trump 4 years ago, but felt more confident in doing so this time around.
I will say this is the first election cycle that I've seen people my age have excitement about Trump.
President Donald J. Trump!
When he did take to the stage, Mr. Trump's speech jumped from topic to topic, from border security, crime, and a plan for mass deportations, to inflation, tariffs and fracking. But he kicked off by making his main basic argument.
Are you better off now than you were 4 years ago?
I don't think so.
We will end inflation. We will stop the invasion of criminals into our country.
At one point, President Trump told the crowd that we take Pennsylvania, we take the whole deal. In many ways, he could be right. But the same is also true of Vice President Harris. And certainly on the 5th of November, this state will be crucial to securing the path to the White House.
Thank you, everybody. Thank you very much. God bless you all.
Will Grant. Well, staying with the US election, some users on X who spend their days sharing content that includes election misinformation, AI-generated images, and unfounded conspiracy theories say they're being paid thousands of dollars by the social media site. The BBC's disinformation correspondent, Mariana Spring, has the latest.
So I'm out in Tampa in Florida at the moment because I've been spending some time tracking down some of the people who are part of these networks of accounts on X, groups of accounts that regularly reshare each other's content all the time, you know, every hour, every day, certainly in the build up to the presidential election day next week. And what I found is, you know, some of these people are sharing stuff that's true or just their political opinions, but some of the stuff isn't true. AI generated images, unfounded conspiracy theories, election misinformation. And it can range from videos that are making claims about voter fraud, which are then contradicted by authorities that turn out not to be real or true. It also includes doctored images, AI generated images of Kamala Harris or Donald Trump, other very extreme allegations without evidence to support them. And I wanted to try and figure out how X has become the home to these kinds of networks and why that's happened. And a lot of that seems to come down to decisions about how the accounts can make money. X has changed its rules now so that accounts make money based on, if they're eligible, interactions with other accounts, premium users, rather than through ad revenue. And what that means for these networks of accounts is that basically the more traction you get, the better. I spent some time with one of the people who is part of these networks, someone called Freedom Uncut. He's by no means the most extreme example of this, but he generates his own AI memes content. Some of it is really obviously satirical. Some of it's less fantastical. And he gave me some insight into just how much money some of the users on X are making.
Oh, I know people that are making the pay periods every 2 weeks. And I know people that are in, you know, the 1,000+ range. It'll depend on what they do. And a lot of them have like a method, right? So if they do certain things and they do them regularly, they can do pretty well. But it's at that point, it really does become a job.
Fascinating, Mariana. Can you tell us more? What sorts of things are being posted online that can be considered disinformation?
So I think what's interesting is, and it's worth saying this, you know, these networks exist to support both Donald Trump, Kamala Harris, and independent candidates too. Someone like Freedom Uncut considers himself to be an independent, although he would rather Donald Trump be president over Kamala Harris. But I also spoke to accounts that are part of the Kamala Harris supporting networks, some of whom have shared unfounded conspiracy theories, for example, suggesting that the assassination attempt on Donald Trump in July was staged in some way. A lot of this is disinformation or hate taking aim at the person you don't like at the other side, and it is racking up millions of views. And as Freedom Uncut explained to me, it is the provocative stuff, the stuff that triggers a reaction, which is tending to get the most views and the most eyeballs.
You're in the media, right? So controversy, you know, sex sells, right? You know, so people like controversial stuff. A lot of people play the game on X where they egg on the other side. They, what I call going across enemy lines. So they'll go post directly in a Harris feed or, you know, someone and egg people on. I don't think I do that. I think, you know, maybe some would say I do it a little bit, but, I think that I do provocative stuff, but usually based in some version of reality.
I contacted X, the social media site, and put these points to them. I asked them whether they're incentivizing users to post these kinds of things on their site. They didn't get back to me and they didn't respond to requests to interview their owner, Elon Musk. And they have not got back to me except once over the past year now.
That was the BBC's Mariana Spring speaking to us from Florida. The latest from the UK now. The Finance Minister of the United Kingdom, Rachel Reeves, has just finished delivering the first budget by a Labour Party government for 14 years. At the start of her budget address to Parliament, the UK's first ever female Chancellor of the Exchequer blamed the previous Conservative government for leaving a funding gap of almost $30 billion.
In July, I exposed a £22 billion black hole at the heart of the previous government's plans. of promises that they made but had no money to deliver. Covered up from the British people, covered up from this House. The Treasury's reserve, set aside for genuine emergencies, spent three times over just 3 months into the financial year.
Ms. Reeves told Parliament that in order to deal with this financial reality, taxes would have to go up by about $50 billion. Well, joining me now is the BBC World Service UK political correspondent Rob Watson. Rob, the UK has been waiting for this for quite some time. It really does set out the government's priorities for years to come, doesn't it?
It does indeed, and it is very significantly different to what the previous Conservative government was doing for the last 14 years. It's rather different to what some other large European economies are doing. And by that, Celia, I mean this is an out-and-out tax spend and borrow kind of budget. So the government, the new Labour government, is really significantly increasing the size of the estate, the amount it taxes, the amount it spends, and the amount it borrows.
How do you think this budget will be received by the public?
Well, I think it's one of the way to answer that, I guess, Celia, is you know, how does it work out? I mean, does it deliver better public services? Will people think, yeah, you know what, the schools are better, the hospitals are better? Does it deliver an increase in living standards? Does it deliver economic growth? Now, the independent forecaster, which the government uses to sort of assess or mark its homework, suggests that there will be a lot more spending on public services, hospitals, schools, that kind of thing. But interestingly, and I would say probably rather worryingly for the government, despite this huge increase in borrowing, spending and taxation, the Office of Budget Responsibility, the independent marker of the government's homework, suggests that it won't actually have a pretty marked effect either on living standards or on economic growth in this country, which will remain pretty anemic by post-World War II standards, Celia.
Just briefly, Rob, how does Labour's plan differ from those of other G7 nations?
Well, some other G7 nations have gone, particularly if you think of France and others, they're going more for austerity. They're thinking they need to cut back spending. This is expansionary. This is a government saying, you know what, we are going to borrow more money, but we're going to use it, we hope, to make, in the longer term, the economy more productive by spending on infrastructure, good services, good schools, good hospitals.
Always good to hear from you, Rob. Thank you. That was the BBC's World Service's UK political correspondent, Rob Watson. Lots more to come on NewsHour. Do stay with us. I'm Celia Hatton with NewsHour, coming to you on the BBC World Service. Well, just 2 years ago, China's president Xi Jinping declared that his dream was to build his country into a space power. And China is making such fast-paced progress that it's raising concerns in Washington. In its latest mission, a Chinese space rocket has lifted off carrying three astronauts to China's Tiangong space station for a six-month stay. And two on board are from the next generation of astronauts. Our China correspondent Laura Bicker witnessed the launch in northwest China.
I'm standing at the edge of the Gobi Desert waiting for the launch of Shenzhou 19. This is China's latest mission to its homegrown space station called Tiangong, or Heavenly Palace. The BBC has been given rare access to this launch centre, and I'm just about a kilometre away from the spacecraft itself. So we're expecting one almighty roar. This launch is yet another step in a growing space race, a battle which could eventually decide who owns the moon.
Okay,
The three chosen to fly to China's homegrown space station were introduced from behind glass to prevent infection. They include the country's first female space engineer, Wang Haozi.
I dream of exploring the vastness of space, waving to the stars, and of course, looking back at my homeland.
The team have trained together for a year to conduct experiments and carry out spacewalks. The pilot is a veteran, but both Wang and her crewmate are China's next generation of space explorers. And this year they watched their country carry out an historic first and collect lunar samples from the far side of the moon. China also has a fleet of satellites in space and has plans for many more, a rival to Elon Musk's Starlink. President Xi has described China's space ambitions as the eternal dream. But every year, that dream gets a little closer. This country is making technological advances with every mission to space. And it has Washington worried. The head of NASA has said that the US and China is in a new space race. Li Yinliang from China's Manned Space Flight Agency told us the country's discoveries belonged to the world.
I think his concerns are unnecessary. We adhere to the principles of peaceful use, equality, mutual benefit, and joint development.
Hundreds have gathered along the streets in the dark to wave flags and brightly coloured lights as the taikonauts make their last few steps on Earth before heading to the launch site. The brass band strikes up Ode to the Motherland as young children kept up late for the occasion. Their cheeks adorned with the Chinese flag shout every note. This is a moment of national pride. China's rivalry with the US is no longer just based here on Earth. Both could soon be staking territorial claims well beyond this planet.
Laura Bicker at the site of China's latest space launch. And let's stay in China, where the authorities are reacting to an unwelcome decision by the European Union to place tariffs on Chinese-made electric vehicles. Extra tariffs, some are topping 35%, come into effect today. The new costs follow an investigation by the European Commission, which found China's electric car industry was gaining an unfair advantage through Chinese state subsidies, undercutting European automakers. So what does China have to say about this? Tu Li is the founder of the Beijing-based advisory company Sino Auto Insights, and he's co-host of the China EVs and More podcast.
They're a bit incredulous because over the last 35, 40 years, the European automakers have really grown in taking a lot of their profits from the China market. So to now protect their own domestic market, I think they're a bit in shock, but not surprised.
How does China's EV development compare to other countries and regions? The news is out today that the Chinese electric car maker BYD has overtaken its U.S. rival Tesla with an operating revenue of more than $28 billion. That's just in the third quarter of this financial year. So can you put it into context for us?
Sure. So the China market has been the number one market since 2009 for passenger vehicles. And the amazing story of the China EV Inc. really has only happened over the last 5 to 7 years. Now, the green shoots started in 2009 when investment subsidies were put into battery manufacturing and software and EVs, but they still struggled until Tesla came in 2019, 2020. But now we're starting to see these companies hit their stride. The products are great. much better than anything, whether you're American, European, or Japanese, the legacies have on offer from a clean energy standpoint.
Mm, just briefly, too. I mean, you say 2009. I mean, so some might argue then that China's EV industry is so advanced because it simply got into the game so much earlier than other countries.
That's true. But I also would argue that they move a lot quicker. Now, it should be noted that the legacy companies also have internal combustion engine, huge sales and operations on those. And so the key for them to really be thriving in the future is to know when to transition out of the traditional auto ICE vehicles and into the EVs. And that's what they're having problems with or challenges with right now.
Mm. And really, just briefly, too, I mean, when you look out on the streets of China, how common is it to see an electric vehicle versus a traditional diesel vehicle?
Let's say in the tier one cities, it's about 50%. There's a lot of green plates in Shanghai, Beijing, a lot of them, not only on passenger vehicles, but on taxis and fleet vehicles. And so it's starting to penetrate into the lower tier cities, but it's about one or two in a Beijing or a Shanghai.
To Lee from the advisory company Sino Auto Insights. Well, that's all from us on NewsHour for now. From me, Celia Hatton, and the rest of the team, thanks for listening.
The race to become the next president of the United States is on.
We can't drop the pace now.
Yeah, it's pretty close.
Count on the BBC World Service to keep you informed on the latest breaking news, with insight and analysis you can trust.
Immigration, if you look at polls, a top concern for so many U.S. voters.
The issue of the economy reigns supreme for everybody.
For a global perspective on the U.S. election, search for The Global Story, the documentary, and The Global News Podcast, wherever you get your BBC podcasts.